right here on CrimsonCast.com. Welcome back, folks. Galen Clavio here. This is the Bracket Racket, our weekly talk on college basketball. We got a little bit of interference on the line there. Kyle, I think your phone is tossing its cookies. But we are going to be joined for the next 90 minutes by our regular panelists, Kyle, David, and Lee. Lee's going to be joining us a little bit later on. David, let me bring you on first. David Griggs with us once again. David, how are you doing? How has been your – this is kind of a weird pre-week of basketball. Have you seen much, or are there things that you're enjoying thus far in the college basketball season?
No. Like I always say, the exhibition games, it's like going to a great restaurant when you're starving, hungry, and you get there and all they give you are crackers. It's like, where's the real food?
I agree. This is tough. I mean, there's a lot of anticipation, and we've obviously got some games finally coming up this week. We've got some games to talk about, but it seems like it's taken forever. It really does. Like, I mean, it seems like practice started a month ago, and there's so much news. There's so many little things going on, and I just feel like we need to get some action underway. And there's some metaphors I could use for that, but I'm not going to right now. But I'm happy we finally got games coming up this week. We're going to talk about those coming forward. Kyle Lamb. Kyle, are you there?
I'm here, although it keeps telling me I'm muted.
Okay, well, I was muting you because it sounded like you were, chopping trees down or something like that on your phone line. You sound much better right now, so I'm glad that we've worked things out. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I was probably typing, and that's probably why you heard that. So, I'm guessing that's what the sound was. I was just listening, to your football show, and I was kind of thinking, like, I had nightmares of the a repeat of Connecticut and Indiana having to swallow $4 million in tickets, unsold tickets for the Rose Bowl. Hopefully that doesn't happen. But
I have a strange suspicion that if IU were to make the Rose Bowl in football, that somehow we would sell all of the tickets that we had at our disposal. Like I think IU fans, even though football is kind of the second sport here, I think that going to Pasadena to the Rose Bowl would get enough people excited that they would sell out without a whole lot of problems.
I think so. I mean, we're only talking like 12,000 tickets. That shouldn't be too difficult to sell.
I would buy 8, and I would just give them out to people.
For me to buy any.
Well, that's right. I will bring David along with me to the Rose Bowl if that happens. So the problem is not selling tickets to the Rose Bowl. The problem is selling tickets to the All-American Bowl or going to the Buffalo Wild Wings Bowl. Like those will cause low attendance figures. But anyway, we're not here to talk about college football. We're here to talk about college basketball. And you know what? We have 125 games scheduled for Friday, and I'm looking forward to it. I really am. I'm excited. This is always a tough month, as I was just talking to David about, so the anticipation's finally over. We've already had some news this week, though. I think this just broke. I don't know if you folks saw this, but Shabazz Muhammad, of course, still not technically eligible, but he's out for 2 to 4 weeks with a shoulder injury. We've had some NCAA news as far as some new rules being passed. We've had, one of the UCLA guys was ruled eligible. We're still waiting to hear what's going on with some of the IU players as far as their eligibility is concerned. There's been a lot of little stuff that's been going on here recently, Kyle.
Yeah, there is. I'm curious what this news that just broke is, because I probably didn't see it if it just happened this evening. One of the things that, one of the recent developments, obviously, was the NCAA basically saying they're going to punish coaches for NCAA violations committed by players that, under their under their direction. Pardon?
And assistant coaches as well.
Yeah, and assistant coaches as well. And I think this is something I've actually been pushing for. I know you and I have had many conversations on this topic, and I actually wish they would extend this to athletic directors as well. But I think this is, personally, I think this is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about this issue a little bit more in our issue of the week. We'll chat about this NCAA push to increase the accountability of head coaches and what that means as far as the game itself is concerned. Let's start off our program here by giving you folks a preview of what games are going on Friday, of course, the 9th of November. That is the official kickoff date for college basketball season. Let me hit a couple of the higher-profile games that are going on. Of course, the only game, I believe, between two ranked opponents is taking place on an aircraft carrier, the Battle of the Midway at San Diego. Syracuse traveling to San Diego to take on San Diego State. And, you know, this is an interesting game because we're curious to see how Syracuse looks as far as their, you know, obviously there's no more Fab Mello. You know, they're missing a couple of other really good players that went to the NBA. They have a nice nucleus. They're in the top 10. They take on a San Diego State team that seems like they're going to be on the downhill slope of, you know, the heights that they reached with Kawhi Leonard a couple of years ago. They had a decent season last year. That should be a pretty interesting game, and that's one that I know a lot of people are going to be looking out for. Also going on involving ranked teams, you've got Michigan State versus Connecticut at Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany. That game taking place at 5:30 Eastern on Friday. You've got Kentucky and Maryland at the Barclays Center Classic in Brooklyn. You've got Marquette and Ohio State in a different carrier classic, different ocean. This one happening in the Atlantic. This one happening in Charleston, South Carolina. You got Miami of Ohio, North Carolina State. You got Florida, Georgetown, that game taking place in Jacksonville. You got UCLA, Indiana State. I mean, I got to tell you guys, and David, let me get your thoughts on this. We were lamenting last week about the lack of a real emphatic start to the season for college basketball when we were talking about moving the schedule forward potentially in the future to make it a spring-only sport. But I got to say, even though this is taking place on a Friday, I'm really impressed with the slate of games that they've given us to start off the season this year.
I think the last 2 years there's been a very good smattering of games on the first Friday of the season. Another one that you missed, this is one that's kind of off the radar, but it is on television, South Dakota State going to Alabama. South Dakota State, we saw them last year. They have four of their starters back. They got a really good guard. And, again, that's a chance for them to pick up a notable road win. And like you said, there's a lot of good games. It's just getting back to last week, you almost wish there was a little bit of a brighter spotlight on some of these because this is it. Like, they're going to look at these games, the committee, as closely as they look at the games in January, February, and March. I mean, these do count. What happens in these games play a role in whether or not teams get in or not.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, obviously, for the teams that are going up against big competition like Syracuse, San Diego State, you know, like Marquette, Ohio State, there's a lot of concentration that's going to go into those games as far as the media is concerned. But even some of the big names going up against non-name competition, these are important games as well because you're trying to get the season started on the right foot. Some of those games include Indiana hosting Bryant in their first game of the season, that taking place at Assembly Hall. Michigan taking on Slippery Rock. Way to stretch yourself out there, Michigan. Duke hosting Georgia State. That game's going to be on TV, actually, on ESPNU. UCLA taking on Indiana State. That's kind of a fascinating game. I'm really kind of curious to see how those two teams match up against each other. So even the big guys taking on the little guys, there's going to be some intrigue in terms of how they handle it and what sort of start they get off to. And the nice thing is that once these games start, it's not like we have a huge respite. I mean, there's 51 games scheduled for Saturday. There's 41 games scheduled for Sunday. So you're talking about 200 basketball games being played in the span of 3 days. And that, to me, is exciting, Kyle.
Yeah, my biggest regret is that the opening night we don't have a air carrier game out on the Baltic Sea. You know, I feel like that's about the only one of the major oceans missing.
Yeah, we need to they've done the carrier thing, and they almost overplayed the carrier thing. I mean, you got two different carrier games, you got an Air Force base game. We need to figure out some other surface that they could play on. You got an idea, David?
Yeah, submarine game. We will submerge the court, you know, into the middle of the ocean and play underwater.
maybe like a bubble. We could put a bubble on the bottom of a bay. I could just see that being disastrous, though. So maybe we avoid that.
Barge.
I keep waiting.
Yeah, put a court on a barge and send it down the Ohio River and play as the. I mean, it'll be in attendance of thousands. Is you know, lining the banks of the river and to watch the barge go down the. Why do we need to play on aircraft carriers?
I mean, it is fun. It's nice for the troops. It does seem a little bit superfluous. I like this idea. Chronic Hoosier just suggested we put IU Kentucky on a barge on the Ohio River. The problem there is Kentucky claims like 4/5 of the river. So we couldn't find a neutral spot on the river. That would be the real issue there. So I don't know how we would handle that. But anyway.
Well, it'd be great. You know, they could go from Cincinnati to Louisville just sailing down the river during the game.
While the game's going. So there you go.
Yeah,
you could do a doubleheader. Cincinnati, Louisville, and Indiana, Kentucky on the barge sailing from Cincinnati to Louisville. I like that idea a lot, actually. But you know what? It is a little gimmicky, but by the same token, it's cool that we're at least doing something that's attracting attention. I'm surprised we haven't seen more open-air games being played. I mean, with the success of the Winter Classic, obviously you don't want to play basketball in winter conditions, but in early November there's still plenty of places you could play outside where you could have decent weather, and you it would be kind of a cool situation to do that. I don't know exactly where you would put it, but it's something that maybe somebody should try. I'm surprised we haven't tried it yet.
I agree with that, actually. I know I just, you know, denounced gimmicks, but I think it would be great to go to some place. I don't know what Rucker Park is in New York, but some place, you know, of significance or of legend like that, and play a game there.
I thought about that. Absolutely. No. Yeah. Something like that. Someplace with some culture and some history where you could have a decent crowd, you know, watching the game. It would be a cool idea. But anyway, we don't have that this year. Maybe it's something to think about moving forward. So with all of these games, let me ask you guys this. Which game are you most intrigued by to start off with? What game are you most interested in seeing? David, let me start with you on that.
One you didn't name, Lehigh at Baylor. Again, Lehigh is interesting. I think we remember their win against Duke last year in the NCAA tournament. I believe all their starters are back, or four of them. I think they got five of their six top scorers back. You know, generally when a team goes to the second round and returns that much of their nucleus, they're getting a lot of attention. Well, I mean, Lehigh didn't. They're not getting that much attention. It's understandable why they're not. But if they want to get attention, if they beat Baylor, that will do it. I think that's a great first game for both teams.
Okay. Kyle?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really curious. I'm really curious to see how Florida does against Georgetown on Friday night. And I think that's an excellent game. You know, Georgetown is a little bit tricky to predict what they're going to be like, you know, with a couple of losses. But nonetheless, they're probably going to finish in the top five of the Big East this year. And obviously Florida, you know, is ranked in the preseason top 10. So I'm really curious to see how Florida does. I believe that game is being played in Jacksonville. So it's kind of a quasi-home game for Florida. But I think that game, of all the games Friday night, I think that's the one that excites me the most.
I think that's a good choice.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Do you guys know Virginia is at George Mason? Are they actually going to Mason's campus, or are they just playing like somewhere in D.C. and splitting it and calling it Mason's home game?
Does Mason have a campus?
I thought they were just
like a collection of buildings in a mini mall.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Okay.
I'm kidding, of course. I'm not sure where that game is being held. We'll get our crack research staff on that and see if we can figure that out. But I tipped my hand earlier. I guess I'm intrigued the most right now by UCLA Indiana State, partially because I want to see if UCLA has any sort of cohesion on the floor together. But I'm also curious to see how they match up against a Missouri Valley team, which can normally be a decent harbinger of how they're going to face up against you know, teams that have some discipline and are fairly well coached. And Indiana State's been okay here as of late. So I'm kind of curious to see how that goes. I'm also curious because I think UCLA is the biggest wild card in the entire pack right now, the top 25. Like, they're 13th. I think you could make an argument that they were a top six team in the country. You could also make an argument that they don't belong in the top 25. So, you know, that's something that I really want to keep an eye on. And it's a late game, so I'll actually get to watch it. I'll be home in time to watch that game. It looks like it's on Pac-12 Network, so maybe I won't get to watch it because, of course, I have DirecTV and we don't get the Pac-12 Network yet. But that's what Tune It In and all that stuff on internet's for, so we can watch games that we're not legally allowed to. Right, Kyle?
Yeah, I can get you that.
Yeah. So anyway,
I have no comment in case anybody is listening.
I bet you don't. I do. I did want to say one thing additional before we get to our next segment. If you look at the games on Saturday, there aren't as many name games. I mean, Evansville Notre Dame should be interesting. There's a few others that are interesting, but there are some bizarre opponents. Tennessee Tech at 9 o'clock at night is playing a team called Crowley's Ridge. I don't know if this is like is this an AAU team that's decided to play up to the college level or what's going on?
They're an NAIA team.
Okay, and then UAB is playing Young Harris.
Yes, Young Harris College, out of Georgia.
Where are they located?
Somewhere in Georgia. Young Harris. Okay, the story behind this is UAB was slated to play Friday night against Texas Southern. The game was set, and Mike Davis took the job after the game being set. And, you know, UAB did not want to run the risk of scheduling a game that people might be intrigued by and actually want to come see. So they ended up canceling that game and in the 11th hour getting Young Harris instead, which I believe has 1,100 students in Georgia. I don't even know if they're two or three. What a ridiculous...
Don't mistake them for Old Harris.
I mean, they're yeah. not. They may not even win. They may not even win the best name. I mean, North Florida is playing Edward Waters. Delaware State's playing Gwinnett Mercy College. So they're this one of the things I love about these first week and a half of the college basketball season is the Division II, Division III NAIA schools that certain college teams go up against are just classic. Like, you'll never see these teams. They just pop up on the schedule, and you just wonder, what must that experience have been like to watch?
Monday night, ESPN has UMBC playing.
Hold on. Kyle, go ahead.
I think the best one of them all. It's obviously a typo. At least I hope so. But night, ESPN list, UMBC is playing E.
E?
E.
Wow.
The letter E.
Well, I'm looking forward to that one, absolutely. So, anyway, let's move on here as we just wanted to give you a little bit of a preview of the schedule, let you know what was going on. And as Lana Turner Overdrive in chat just said, we should call this Income Redistribution Week in college basketball.
got
a valid point. Anyway, we wanted to continue on. If you missed us last week, we previewed some of the big conferences. We previewed the Big Ten, the Big East, and the ACC. So we're going to tackle the other three quote-unquote major conferences in college basketball, the Big 12, the Pac-12, and the SEC. Now, I tend to think that these three are in a second tier from the ones that we talked about on Sunday last. We're also going to talk about some mid-major conferences. That'll come a little bit later on in the show. But, Kyle, let me start with you, and let's go ahead and start with the SEC. Obviously, you know, Kentucky every year seems to just obliterate this conference. They're far and away the most talented team in this conference year in, year out. There do seem to be a couple of other teams, though, in the SEC this year that might give Kentucky a run for their money. How do you see this conference playing out, and who should we be looking out for?
Well, the hype is surrounding, you know, Kentucky, probably three teams, Kentucky and Florida and Missouri. Personally, I'm still not sure about Missouri. They've had some off-season issues with some injuries and suspensions, and Their depth is really, you know, taking a hit, although they do, you know, obviously they do, you know, have a couple key players coming in, a couple recruits, and, of course, you know, the transfer from Connecticut. I'm not sure I'm really buying into the Missouri hype. I personally think it's gonna be a Florida-Kentucky battle for the SEC this season. I mean, the SEC is going to be, you know, probably the upper half of the conference will be better than maybe it's been the last couple of years, but the bottom half is still going to be pretty weak. I just don't see – it's one of those situations where you kind of touched on it a little bit last week. I'm not sure Kentucky is going to have a Kentucky-like season, but there's just not a lot of obstacles in their way in this conference this year. And so by default, I mean, Kentucky – if Florida doesn't beat them, I'm just not sure there's anybody. I mean, they'll lose some games, but I'm just not sure there's anybody capable of winning the conference other than Florida.
I mean, Kentucky, of course, did grab the number one overall spot in the KenPom preseason rankings. Now, a lot of that was due to their position as the national champions last year. They've obviously got a whole new team coming in. You know, you look at what they did in the SEC last year, the only game they lost in the SEC, well, actually, they didn't lose a game in the conference. They lost a game in the conference tournament. Vanderbilt beat them. And you look down the stretch, I mean, all throughout the conference season, they really weren't tested. You know, I mean, the closest games they had, they won by 3 at Tennessee early on in the conference schedule. They won by 6 at home versus Alabama. They won by 6 at Vanderbilt. And I think those were the only games where they didn't win by at least double digits. That's not a conference that illustrates a great deal of parity. Even Florida, who was obviously a very good team, made it to the Elite Eight last year, was a top 15 team in the KenPom rankings. They beat Florida by 20 at home, and they beat them by 15 in Gainesville. And they beat them. They did only beat them by 3 in the SEC tournament, but still, I think the point had been made by then.
Florida, they had their doors blown off during the season, but that semifinal game, Florida took them to the wall.
Yeah, but still, you're dealing with a situation where in conference, Florida has yet to demonstrate that they're able to compete with. I mean, I don't think Kentucky, frankly, really cared about the SEC tournament. I think that showed in the final two games they played.
I did want to mention too, and I meant to bring this up when you asked the question, and I forgot to do so. But I also want to throw Arkansas's name out there. Because this is a team I really think could surprise some people this year. You know, they've done a pretty good job of scheduling. They've got, you know, Arizona State, Syracuse, Oklahoma, and Michigan all in a stretch of non-conference games, which I thought was pretty impressive. But I mean, they've got Marshawn Powell, who might be one of the best players in the SEC this year, returning. They've got, you know, their great young freshman guard B.J. Young is back. This could be a very, very good team. You know, Arkansas might have something to cheer about finally for the first time in several years.
Well, the SEC right now has, if you look at the KenPom preseason rankings, 9 of the 14 teams are preseason rated in the top 100. Kentucky, Florida, Missouri, Alabama, Tennessee, Vanderbilt, Mississippi, Georgia, and Arkansas. Now, obviously, I don't think all 9 of them are going to be sniffing the NCAA tournament, but David, I don't think it's a stretch to think that 5, maybe 6 of these teams could be vying for bids by the end of the year.
I don't think it's a stretch. In fact, I think it's an expectation. I mean, another team that we haven't mentioned, I like this Tennessee team. They got off to a really weak start, but toward the end of the conference season, they were playing very well, and it looked like they might actually, if they were able to go on a run in the SEC tournament, play their way inside the bubble. Granted, that had a lot to do with how weak the bubble was, but they have just about everybody coming back. I think they lost Tatum, but everybody else is back.
Right.
So that's another good team. And, I mean, as far as the SEC, you have Kentucky and Florida who might get, you know, on the top tier, but then you have, you know, Tennessee. Kyle already talked about Arkansas. You have Missouri, who's really good. This is a good conference. I mean, I don't really consider it any worse than the ACC, who we talked about last week. I think it's probably better this year.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's okay. I think Kentucky and Florida are going to be bona fide contenders this year. I think that they both have the look of Sweet 16 teams, at least early on. I think I don't trust Frank Haith. I didn't trust him last year, and I looked foolish right up until the NCAA tournament started, and then I no longer looked foolish. I think Alabama's got a lot of promise. I mean, Anthony Grant has done a great job with that team defensively. They were very, very good defensively last year. They're projected to be a top 10 team defensively this year. That's a team that could give squads fits down the stretch. And I think they're projected right now maybe as a 12-6 team in that conference. And I'm already on record as saying I do love this Tennessee team. I think Konzo Martin has done an excellent job putting the pieces back together. Yeah. I think he's very, very good. Outside of those five teams, though, I don't know that anybody else is going to make it into the tournament. Kyle, I understand your thoughts on Arkansas, but that whole group, Vanderbilt, Mississippi, Georgia, and Arkansas, very mediocre. I mean, they could break out. They could just as easily fall back into the pack. And you get below that, the bottom five teams in the SEC may be the worst bottom five in any of the major conferences.
Well, the ACC is going to challenge them for that. But,
I mean, it's going to be a horse race. Yes, I agree.
Bottom five are pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking here Texas A&M, LSU, South Carolina, Auburn, Mississippi State. Just I'm not sold on any of those teams being able to do any of them eclipse six wins in conference? I mean, I think that's a legitimate question. I mean, right,
And Frank Martin is going to be angry, and it is going to be wonderful.
Yes,
like,
he will.
South Carolina is destination programming for that reason.
He will be incredibly angry throughout the course of the entire season. I think we've got Lee on the phone. Lee, are you there?
Yeah, can you guys hear me?
We can hear you. I'm sorry, you just missed out on us previewing the SEC.
Missed is the word. I don't know if that's the one I would use.
Okay.
As long as I didn't miss the Pac-12 preview, I'm good to go.
That's coming up here in a minute. We're going to do the Big 12 first, and we'll go ahead and jump into that now. Now, the Big 12, this is a different look Big 12 than we're used to, obviously, as they've lost a couple of teams. They've gained Texas Christian, which isn't going to do much on the basketball side. The Texas Tech, that program seems to be disintegrating on a daily basis. Obviously, Billy Gillespie's no longer there. So we can take those two teams out of the conversation. That leaves us with a total of eight teams. And it's an interesting mix because I think all of these teams have some issues, but all of them have the potential of being very difficult to play against. And, you start at the top with Kansas. Kansas obviously surprised a lot of people by going to the national title game last year. They don't have Thomas Robinson anymore. They do still have a very nice core of talent. They look to be the prohibitive favorite in this conference, but you get below them and you've still got a lot of really talented teams, albeit flawed teams. And Lee, let me go ahead and start with you since you just jumped in. You get a West Virginia team that comes into that league, and I think they've been projected to be sixth in that conference. And Bob Huggins' response to that was, if we're the sixth best team in this conference, this must be a hell of a league. Do you agree with that sentiment?
Yeah, I agree with Bob Huggins. I think it's crazy that they're that low. I'll be honest, I'm not very big on the Big 12. I do like Kansas a lot. I do think the loss of Thomas Robinson, at least folks are consistent. If they're going to talk up, if we're going to talk about Ohio State being able to get over the loss of Jared Sollinger, we have to pretty much approach Kansas the same way, I would think, to be fair, because Thomas Robinson, even at the end of last year, I thought he was still underrated for just how great of a player he was. I think it was kind of the all-encompassing aura of Anthony Davis just sucked away the attention from all other players, it seemed like.
Right.
Robinson's a huge loss, but I think Kansas is head and shoulders above anybody else in the league. I really like West Virginia. The recruiting has improved immensely over the last couple of years. I'm interested, of course, to see how they take the style that they play, the aggressive interior Big East style, although that's largely died out over the last 5 years in the Big East and nationally, you could argue. I'm interested to see. Still, they're a pretty big team for the Big 12. After that, I don't think the conference is really that good. The flaws for all of these teams are just so startling. I mean, TCU is a warm body, and that's being very kind. Texas Tech is an absolute just a train wreck is an insult to Amtrak, so I won't even use the term. The bottom is so bad. I actually like the Pac-12 almost a little more because I'm used to the Pac-12 being bad, but this year I have hope. And with the Big 12, it's been so good the last few years, at least solid middle of the road among the top conferences. I think they're ready for a big drop-off. I just don't think it's very good. I'm not casting my lot with Rick Barnes. I do like Lon Kruger at Oklahoma, though. I really think they might make a big jump forward this year. Oklahoma and West Virginia, it's bad.
I'm in the same boat with you on Oklahoma. I'm actually surprised that they've been rated as low as they have been in a lot of the preseason publications and prognostications. I think they've got a lot of potential with Lon Kruger now having had a full year to get his system in. David, you know, it's interesting because we like to pick on Rick Barnes from a coaching perspective, and that's become kind of, you know, it's one of the easiest jokes you can make in college basketball. But now here's a conference that has Rick Barnes, Scott Drew, and Bruce Weber in the same conference. I mean, the possibilities here comedically are just endless, are they not?
Oh, I mean, yes, and that is one
and Frank Hayes.
Really
I mean, let's not forget Frank Hayes is still
in the SEC. No, Frank Hayes is in the SEC. Frank Hayes is in the SEC.
Oh, yeah. So sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I forgot Missouri. Well, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Anyway, David, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one thing the league really has going for it. And I don't, like, I think some of the teams might rise to the top. I was impressed with Iowa State last year. To be honest, I don't know exactly what all they have coming back. But, I mean, they could be pretty good. Baylor, I know that they lost their front court, but they're bringing in, God, what's his name? I know they have an NBA prospect that's coming in, a likely one and done as a senior, as a freshman.
They've got the transfer coming in from Michigan State, the second one. The young point guard. I forget the name. His name's escaped me.
We're all about accuracy here on the bracket.
Yes, we really are. I can see Baylor being really good this year.
I mean, Baylor's always very talented. I mean, it's just a matter of, can they put together a string of results that reflects the talent that they've got? And that always ends up being the question. I mean, their problem is always scheduling as well. And if you look at the schedule that Baylor has this year, it's actually not as bad as it has been. I mean,
Isaiah Austin is the kid's name.
Isaiah Austin. I mean, if you look at Baylor's schedule this year, they've got Lehigh, they've got Kentucky, they've got Northwestern, they've got Brigham Young, they've got Gonzaga. I mean, these are all pretty decent teams that they've got on their schedule. They've got a couple of others as well that are decent. Boston College is not a good team, but their ranking isn't terrible.
Yeah.
College of Charleston, same thing. They've really only got a couple of real stinkers. They've got Lamar, Jackson State, and then their yearly tilt with Hardin-Simmons in January.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, this is a team that's reached the Elite Eight two out of the last 3 years.
Right.
I mean, they haven't done bad. And, again, it's just I think they're always – you know, 2 years ago, they had a very talented team that just kind of faded out, didn't really gel together. But, again, not many teams have been to the Elite Eight twice in the last 3 years. They might be the only one. They're probably – no, they're not. But not many have. So –
right.
As far as them not reaching their potential, I mean, that's pretty good.
I agree. No, I think we hold them to a little bit too high of a standard, but by the same token, they do a lot of things in the conference season that makes us bang our head against the wall because they are so talented physically that they could do so much more than they actually do. Go ahead, Lee, please.
Well, no, I was going to say, actually, with Baylor, couldn't this be the classic addition by subtraction situation where they have had such mental midgetry over the last 2 years? I mean, although it's an excellent point. I mean, two Elite Eights, at the end of the day, it's how do you do in the tournament. You got the two Elite Eights in 3 years. As crazy as they drove us, as maddening as they were on the court, at the end of the day, they had pretty pretty great finishes, all things considered. They just weren't consistent. I think they'll be a much more consistent team this year, but the ceiling is a lot lower. The other team you mentioned is Iowa State. What do they have coming in? Well, what they have coming in is a million JUCOs, and I can't judge the team until I see them. You know, I mean, they had a wonderful year last year. I don't think they can recreate the Royce White magic in back-to-back years. I think that's I love that. I get why they bring in the JUCOs. I think it's a very good move for a program like Iowa State, which is in a good conference but is at severe disadvantages in pretty much every category you can think of. That said, it's still disadvantages. I don't think you can bring in five JUCOs a year and consistently get away with it being an NCAA tournament team every year. So I think Iowa State will have a step back. I don't think the team they had at the end of last year, as well as they played, I think that was mostly Royce White. And like I said, I also like Baylor this year just because even though the ceiling's lower, at least we're not going to be pulling our hair out having to worry about are they, you know, a Final Four seed or not. They're a solid team that's probably going to go to the NCAA tournament, and we can focus our rage and aggression on other teams, such as UCLA.
Kyle, any final thoughts on the Big 12 before we jump off to the Pac-12?
Yeah, one team that hasn't been mentioned for better or worse. My mama always taught me, if first you don't succeed, try again. And that's going to be my rallying cry for Oklahoma State this year. Last year I was kind of high on Travis Ford's team, and they disappointed me quite a bit. Now they do have to replace Keaton Page, which is not going to be easy, but they got a great young guard, Marcus Smart, coming in, one of the top shooting guards in the country. They've got LeBrian Nash back, Michael Cobbins back, Markell Brown. It was a very young team last year for the most part, and they've got the nucleus, beyond Page, they've got the nucleus of the rest of their team back in addition to Smart. I really think that now that Ford's had some time with this team and this program, I think that this is going to be the year that they get to the upper half of the Big 12 conference. That's a team in the Arkansas mold that I really, really want to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I think that's a good one to look at, and their projection is decent as we look at the way that the projections have started, at least. And so I'm curious to see what happens with them. Anyway, we need to jump forward and get to the Pac-12 because we're running out of time in this segment. So the Pac-12, we've loved.
Oh, good. We're running out of time.
Well, we're running out of time with this. Yes, so we might have to rush through the Pac-12. But the
Pac-12,
we love to slag on the Pac-12. The Pac-12 doesn't look
awful.
We're
doing the mid-majors later.
Pac-12 does not look awful this year, guys. I hate to tell you this, but you look at the Pomeroy projections. I said in the SEC, they had eight teams that were rated in the top 100 of the preseason Pomeroys. Well, guess what? Pac-12's got nine of their 12 teams. The only three that aren't are really awful, like Southern Cal, Arizona State, and Utah. Those are going to be three horrendous, horrendous teams. But you get past those, I mean, UCLA, Arizona, Stanford, Cal, Colorado, Oregon State, Washington, Oregon, and Washington State all could do some decent things this year. And, Kyle, UCLA, we've already talked about them being kind of a wild card because we don't know what's going to happen with Shabazz Muhammad. We don't know what's going to happen with Ben Howland. But they're still very talented. And you start going down the list, and you can really find something that you like out of every single one of these squads.
Well, more power to you, because I have a hard time finding something I like out of most of these teams.
Come on!
I'm just saying, I'm not feeling it. I'm one of the most interesting teams to me is really, like, I have no idea what to expect out of Washington this year. They had, obviously, a couple really big losses to the NBA. And I know that, that was kind of a disappointment to them because they had some high hopes for Ross and some of those guys to return for another year. But, they do have Abdul Gaddy, I believe, is supposed to be back. I know he was out last year with an injury, or he got injured, I think, late in the year, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure what his health status is, but he is supposed to return at some point this year. They're high on Giroux and Sean Kemp Jr. is a sophomore this year. This is an interesting team for me. On the surface, I don't think it's an NCAA team, but you know, they're kind of like always in that, or at least, you know, the last several years they've been in that discussion of the bubble. They seem to be hovering, you know, either just inside the bubble or just outside the bubble. And I kind of think that's going to be something that happens again this year.
So I guess I'll, David, I'll go ahead and let you tee off on this as well. Are you on this bandwagon? You don't see anything redeeming out of this conference?
No, I see some things. It's just I kid the Pac-12. I kid because I care. Colorado, I realize that they looked very good. I mean, at the end of the year, obviously they won the conference tournament, and they actually looked good in the NCAA tournament. I think a team we just talked about, was it Baylor that they played in the second round? I realize we're all about accuracy, but they really looked good in that game. They didn't end up winning it. But the thing about Colorado, they lost half their squad. I think they have 6 or 7 freshmen on the team this year, and they're just sort of in reset mode. A team that I think is turning the corner, I don't know if they've turned it all the way to being in the NCAA discussion, but Oregon State has 4 starters coming back. They won 21 games a year ago. I know that I think they finished 7th or 8th, but that's much higher than what they've normally been finishing. They could be kind of dangerous this year. I know that sounds crazy to say, but Oregon State might have something going there.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, and I think, you know, Oregon State, well, it's funny because a lot of these teams, I feel, they've taken a big step in that they're not scheduling as horrendously as they have in the past. Now, Oregon State's a prime example of this because Oregon State, frankly, that most of their schedule is awful this year if you look at it. But they do have a few games that are okay outside of the Pac-12. They do play Kansas. They do play Alabama on a neutral floor. Those are both given. They play New Mexico State. They play San Diego. So that at least it's not a complete dog fest like we've seen in the past. And there's a couple
right,
of other teams that fall into that category as well. I think Washington on the schedule this year has Seton Hall, Colorado State, St. Louis, UConn. So that there's some decent teams being scheduled, which is nice. But Lee, you know, I guess the thing that makes me excited about the Pac-12 is that there might be some depth in the conference this year, and there just hasn't been that in the past. I mean, last year, I guess technically there was a little bit of depth, but it didn't really do itself many favors because they all did so terribly out of conference.
Yeah, this year there's depth, but it's actually, I think, decent depth. I like Oregon. I like Dan Altman, but I think, I never thought I'd say this, I think the Pac-12, I think it's too much of a hill to climb. I like a lot more teams in front of them in the conference. The Pac-12, if you want to use college basketball perspective, the Pac-12 has 10 teams in the top 100. That's more than the SEC, that's as many as the Big Ten, and it's more than the ACC, which only has 8 in the top 100. So that's
right.
Their preseason rankings. So college basketball perspective is high on the conference. I am, and that's in general. If you want to be a fan of them based on the past, you're going to love them because the conference is way better than it has been in the past. We haven't even brought up Stanford, a team that was their defensive efficiency is not going to be a hallmark, to put it mildly, but offensively they're an incredibly efficient team. They're older. Cal crashed and burned. We didn't mention them at the end of last year, but they've got another year under Mike Montgomery. They did finish second last year. They left a very sour taste in everyone's mouth with how their season ended, but they do return 3 starters from a team that did finish second. It'll be interesting to see how they respond. They were a top 50 BPI team last year. And, of course, Galen, though, I mean, UCLA for me, I think even if you take out the ridiculous end of the season last year, they are a legit live Final Four team. This is an absolutely loaded recruiting class. Ben Howland might have a lot of negative things people say about him, but the man can coach. He's been to Final Four. They've been to the cusp of winning a national championship several times, and they have got the core to get back there again. The question is how eligible and how healthy will that core be? Because
right.
Between eligibility issues and injuries, Shabazz Muhammad is already all the entertainment value you could ask for. Because I've got no idea if he'll be eligible, and now he has a shoulder injury. Other teams we didn't mention in the Pac-12 that I want to give some love to, Washington State.
They're a very, you know, a very consistent team. I think this year they could possibly make some noise. I'm just trying to pull up their schedule while I saw here. They're another team, Washington State, similar to Cal, to bring back three starters. They were a dreadful team last year in all the rankings, but they did go to Australia in the exhibition season, and they do have three Australians, so they're trying to channel the St. Mary's route. I don't
right.
know if they'll be enough in the tournament, but at least they're going after the right model.
Well, we'll see how it plays out. The Pac-12, I really do think they'll exceed their two teams in the tournament last year. I could see them getting four or five in this year, which would be incredible if that were to actually happen. I mean, that conference has been so down here in the last 5 years or so. It would be nice to see them bounce back because I do think that the coaches that are there have started to build things that will move forward and make it a better conference overall. But anyway, we're way over time on this segment. We've got to take a break. We're going to come back with our issue of the week. We'll also talk a little mid-major basketball. There's a lot of things to talk about there. Stick with us. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to the Bracket Racket here on Crimson Cast and HoopsHD.com.
The only live sports talk show dedicated solely to IU football and basketball is Crimson Cast Live, Wednesdays this fall from 9 to 11 right here on Crimson Cast. Every week we walk you through the keys to the game for your Hoosier squad and bring you interviews with the top writers and reporters covering IU sports today. Plus, Crimson Cast Live takes your phone calls and questions regarding Indiana University athletics at 626-696-8557. Join us every Wednesday night from 9 to 11 p.m. Crimson Cast Live. For the best in news and opinion on Indiana University athletics, check out IU Sportcom. IU Sportcom is the only all-digital, all-sports website dedicated to bringing you the best in coverage of IU football, IU basketball, IU volleyball, IU soccer, and more. IU Sportcom brings you content from the student perspective, including written stories, video reports, podcasts, live broadcasts, and social media. Get the latest Hoosier news at www.iusportcom.com.
Welcome back, folks. Galen Clavio here. This is the Bracketology Show, the Bracket Racket, as it were, as we get set for our final 40 minutes here on the show. If you'd like to call in, 626-696-8557. We'll also take your tweets at any point. You can tweet us at CrimsonCast or at HoopsHD, as we will be trying to answer as many of those as we can. We were going to go ahead and get to our issue of the week. And this is a new feature that we've added to the show, and we're looking forward to having it throughout the course of time here, as there's a lot of things going on with college basketball. And frankly, you know, our entire focus is trying to get those issues out and talk about them. And we wanted to talk a little bit about the situation involving the NCAA and what they're trying to do as far as the punishment and the rules that are out there relating to not just college basketball, but all sports. And Kyle, you brought this up, so I'll kind of let you take the reins on it. But the NCAA trying to hold head coaches more accountable for the actions of people in their programs. And this is something that obviously we've talked about in the past, but you're really in favor of what they're trying to do.
Yeah, I really am. One of the problems that we've had in college basketball, and I mean college football to a lesser extent, but college basketball especially, is in recruiting and just, you know, in the programs in general. Coaches right now, they basically like to turn a blind eye to things that are happening with, you know, with boosters and people around the program. Because right now, if you're a coach and you know that an athlete might be taking, you know, a couple $100 handouts, you know, you've got no incentive to stop it, you know, because worst thing that happens is, you know, if it is discovered, the player is the one that's suspended and the coach doesn't get in trouble. So basically what the NCAA has done now is they basically said these petty violations that affect eligibility could now affect, you know, the coach's eligibility. They could be suspended for, you know, head coaches or assistant coaches could be suspended for games and weeks or even seasons at a time if it's discovered that either they knew about these taking place, you know, taking place, or they should have known that they were taking place. And so now the coaches basically, I think there's more of an incentive for them to not only not cheat themselves, but for them to not be as, oh, golly gee, I didn't know this was going on, you know, towards their athletes getting into trouble with, you know, with petty violations. So I think this is a great first step by the NCAA. And, you know, there are some coaches that are just going to be continue to be, you know, for lack of a better term, sleazy. But I think the ones that truly aren't necessarily cheating themselves but are just very ho-hum and lackadaisical about this, you know, for their own benefit now, they're going to have to be a little more proactive in trying to keep players away from these outside influences.
David, what are your thoughts on this issue? I mean, obviously, you come at it from a somewhat different perspective. How do you see this working within the confines of what's there already, and what do you think of the overall approach?
Well, I kind of like, I mean, I think what they're going at is they're trying to eliminate the idea of a head coach pressing upon his assistants or, you know, subordinates to say, just get it done. I don't care what you do. Just get it done. And if you don't get it done, I'll get someone that will. And then turning their back. And essentially, I mean, the pressure is on them to get it done one way or another, whether they have to cheat or not. And the coach can plausibly say, well, I didn't know. I think the goal of this is to cut through the plausibility and say, well, you should have known. You know, they're under you. And the whole thing that was set into motion was the pressure that you put on them to get a job done, be it to sign a recruit, to make contact with a recruit, or something like that. I think that's where it's coming from. What scares me is I just think that when you have diddle brains that are in charge, should have known. Well, what constitutes what they should and shouldn't have known? And again, it's inconsistent. One of the things that happened recently, Lance Thomas from Duke, who purchased all that jewelry from, I guess everybody's familiar with this story. He put a $30,000, you know, dollar down payment on $100,000 worth of jewelry in New York. At the time he did it, he was actually with his team. This wasn't really talked about, but he was with the Duke basketball team because they were playing Gonzaga in Madison Square Garden, and the NCAA decided that Duke shouldn't have known about that. But at the same time, it was Memphis gets in trouble because they should have known that Derrick Rose was ineligible. Essentially, the infractions committee decided that Memphis should have known that the eligibility center was wrong when they told the University of Memphis that it was okay for him to play. And I guess what scares me in the execution of this is that whole coaches should have known. Who is deciding what coaches should and should not know?
You know, in the Memphis situation, though, I will say the NCAA was right about that because Calipari was informed before the season that Rose's scores were red flagged. And he didn't respond, and he played Rose even knowing that those scores were flagged. So that was, I mean, there was really no excuse for that.
Let's not get into the minutia of the Memphis thing. I want to hear from Lee on this issue because obviously, you could only guess where the impetus for this rule change probably came from.
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know of any program that could have. Well, it's nice to see them make a change for something going forward and not retroactively try and change the, you know, the rules that they were set. That's a nice improvement to see. That's good to fucking see that they decided not to be complete dickbags about it. I like that there, it seems, I've barely read into this because anytime I see NCAA and rules, I avoid it because I don't like having a heart attack. It seems like they're trying to classify things differently, and I'm all in favor of any system in which there are shades of gray introduced, because if we've learned anything, there are shades of gray involved in these cases. I actually, as absurd as it sounds, I do believe there are some cases that these things aren't cut and dry. Lance Thomas, I remember his whole recruitment process, as shady as it seems, he comes from a pretty good background. And I'm actually willing to entertain the fact that, yeah, with his family background, he could have swung that sort of a loan. His family is doing okay. I wouldn't be surprised if it was something shady, but I'm willing to entertain the thought from what I know about his background and his family from following that process. The only shady thing about his recruitment to me was that Rutgers was even considered, just because it's Rutgers. ESPN, the magazine, in their college basketball preview, they have the whole we ask, you know, players questions anonymously. They talk with 87 college players. And they asked, one of the questions was, if your coach asked you to do something you knew was an NCAA violation, would you do it? And 74% of players said they wouldn't do it. Now, whether you want to believe that or not, it's what the results were. As for the 26%, one player who they described as a potential All-American, he said that he would do it even if it was illegal, but he did have reservations. But at the end of the day, he said, my coach is my boss, and if he asks me to keep something quiet, I'm keeping it quiet. So I think a lot of the issue here, as much as we want to talk about agents and shadiness among coaches, is that these players are actually, I think, a lot more loyal to the programs than anyone gives them credit for. And I say this as a fan of a program that has seen almost no player loyalty in the last 5 months. I think, though, every situation is different, and I'm a fan of the NCAA, even though I think they're really powerless on this. At least they're acknowledging that they have to classify these things differently and that there is a problem. We can make fun of the fact that, yeah, it shouldn't have taken them this long to acknowledge that there are problems, but I'm glad that they at least are now doing it. You know, but like I said, you know, they're still assholes.
Here's my thing with this. I agree with Kyle that the idea that you can hold a head coach responsible for what's going on with their staff, I think that's a good one, because if there are infractions, then they're almost certainly not originating because of some rogue assistant coach. I mean, it's a mm-hmm. systematic thing. I'm not opposed to the four categories of violation as opposed to the two that are currently there. But I think there's two bigger issues. One of them is that all we're doing now is basically we've still got two areas of violation. We've got the most major one, and then we've got everything else. And so now you've basically taken the secondary violation market and you've split it into different degrees of severity. It's still, I don't think, not going to matter that much. I mean, I let's wait to see how it's enacted, but I think that ultimately what causes people to stop disobeying the rules is more consistent application of the rules that are on the books, not increasing the rules that are on the books. And that seems to be the way the NCAA is going. But I think the bigger issue, frankly, is the rules on the books. And all of the changes that they can make in enforcement, they aren't solving the problem. And the problem is that in many cases, the rules that are being violated are either ill-informed by the NCAA, or they're out of date, or they're just silly and don't take into account just regular everyday life and the way that people interact with one another. So, you know, Kyle, on this issue, I agree that I don't mind the NCAA saying, all right, we're going to hold people accountable further up the chain. I think that's great. I mean, it'll never happen with university presidents, but you'd love to see a situation where they're starting to get held accountable for some of these things as well. But by the same token, the rules themselves need to be overhauled, and I see nothing currently with the NCAA that indicates that they're interested in that at all. All they seem to be interested in doing is increasing enforcement of the rules, and I think that kind of misses the point.
Well, if I had my way, they would just scrap the rule book entirely and start from scratch, because I think it's bloated, and I think they need to start over with the less is more approach and just put in some common sense rules and go from there. And I think last summer when they had the conference, I think that was the intention. But I think what they ended up doing is they have thrown out a whole bunch of new rules, and I think that they've kind of just conflated what their original intention was in the first place.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. The problem, and we talk about this on the Sports Social every week, folks, if you want to tune into that. But the problem is the NCAA exists primarily as an enforcement department. I mean, they really don't have another reason for existence anymore. Yes, they administer championships, and as Jay Billis has pointed out, that's a great thing for them to do. They actually do that fairly well. Yes, the NCAA does some redistribution of income, but in reality, what they do is they act as the enforcement wing for the colleges that make up the NCAA as an institution. And they've been doing that since the late 50s. That was their entire strategy for survival. You can read Walter Byer's book. He was the longtime NCAA executive committee chairman, and that was his entire thing was, well, if we're going to survive as an institution, we have to be the ones that enforce rules. So when you put the NCAA in charge of the rule book and say you have to enforce this, now you have a situation where there's no impetus whatsoever to do what you just mentioned, Kyle, which is scrap the book, start over, make it more understandable, make it easier for people, whether it's athletes or coaches or programs, to follow. You benefit really by making it as confusing and arcane and Byzantine as you possibly can, and we just continue to see this happening more and more every single year, and more stupid rules added. And now the big thing that the NCAA has is, let's figure out better ways to enforce those rules, when really I think that's just going to create more problems than it does solutions. So anyway, any final thoughts on this topic, David? Let me ask you.
The article that you linked last week, I think that it ran in the Atlantic Monthly, it's sort of related to this, and it's good. It's just the idea of outsourcing the enforcement of it to people that actually know what they're doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the other issue. I mean, you're gonna specialize in enforcement and specialize in making sure rules are followed. Yet you have nobody that's a trained, or maybe one person that's a trained investigator on your staff. These are bigger issues beyond this. But even with that, I mean, you look at this. Okay, so they're adding new levels of rules that need to be, or new levels of violations of rules. They're going to try to hold people accountable. How are they going to investigate these things? Like are they going to hire a bunch of extra staff? No, they're going to try to farm it off on the schools, which is going to increase athletic budgets and then create an even larger mess. So anyway, it's something that's interesting. I think it's, as Kyle said, it's an idea that makes some sense, but by the same token, it's the wrong organization to be doing this at this point, I think. So anyway, let's switch gears. We've got about 23 minutes left in the show, and let's talk a little mid-major action as well. Last week we talked about the Mountain West Conference, and I think that's all we really got time to do. There's obviously a lot more going on in the mid-majors this year, and I think folks maybe will start off looking at the Missouri Valley, as the Missouri Valley had a pretty good year last year. I mean, you look at the way that the conference went, they had two teams that were in the top half of the NCAA tournament from a seeding perspective. Wichita State, a fifth seed overall, Creighton with an eighth seed. Of course, Wichita State lost in their first game. Some people were picking them to go to the Elite Eight. They lost to Virginia Commonwealth in their first game. Creighton fared a bit better. They beat Alabama in a really close game to start off the tournament, and then lost to North Carolina in what was not a particularly close game at all. They lost that game by 14 points. This year they come into the season, and you've got the same cluster of three teams basically that you had from last year that were considered pretty good: Creighton, Wichita State, and Northern Iowa. The rest of the conference looks a little bit questionable. Kyle, this has been kind of one of the darlings of the mid-major constellation for the last decade or so, but it's been kind of not a particularly deep last few years for the Missouri Valley, and it looks like this year is going to be more of the same.
Yeah, they're an interesting league this year. I mean, really, it's kind of funny because, I mean, you mentioned we talked about the Mountain West last week, and really for good reason, because I mean last year especially, and probably this year too, it's really kind of taken the Missouri Valley, as you said, have been the darlings for several years, but really, with Wichita State probably taking a little bit of a downturn. I mean, they still might be an NCAA caliber team, but they're certainly not a top 10 team this year. This is really a difficult conference to put a pulse on. You know, they're going to be tough as always from top to bottom, but there's just, you know, I don't see one of those prototypical, you know, top 20, top 10, top 20, you know, even top 30 type teams from the Missouri Valley this year. You know, I think when you look at, you know, Wichita State, when you look at Creighton, I'm not seeing any of those teams that are going to be like, you know, like maybe some of the games in some of the years in the past where you just like, you circle that game and like, uh-oh, you know, you just don't want to face this type of team. I'm just not seeing that from this league this year.
Well, obviously, Lee, you know, the Creighton's got an All-American. Doug McDermott had an excellent year last year. He's one of the most efficient offensive players in the country. He was, I think, sixth in the nation in effective field goal percentage. He's a very talented player. There's no question about that. You know, they lose Antoine Young. They get Echenique back. They get Grant Gibbs back. They get Will Artino back. They got a lot of players on this Creighton roster. Do you see them, though, as being a team that challenges nationally or threatens to challenge nationally in the same vein as what we saw from, say, Wichita State last year?
Well, the whole issue for Creighton revolves around whether Austin Chapman can step in as the point guard. Because, I mean, Creighton returns four of the five starters, but whenever a team returns four or five starters with the one missing being the point guard, to me it's like a team really only is returning three starters or less, because the point guard is the position, especially in college basketball, where the whole thing goes through. If Chapman can replace, I mean, can just be a standby to replace Young at the point, I think they'll be okay. I think it's a really weak Missouri Valley Conference. I think the two best mid-major conferences, quote-unquote, I think are still the Mountain West. I mean, we barely talked about them last year. The Mountain West this year is going to be awesome. And the A-10 is going to be really, I think, really good. After that, I mean, the Colonial is in the same boat as the Missouri Valley, where there's strength at the top, but the conference isn't as deep as it has been the last few years. I mean, they bring back Grant Gibbs, who's an incredibly versatile player. You know, it's the players. We know McDermott's going to be far and away, I think, the best player in the conference. The questions are, can Chapman step up to the challenge? I mean, he's only 6 foot tall. He's a very small guy to be at the point. I'm not sure if he'll be enough for them at the point to really pull away from this conference as much as they should. And I think, you know, everyone's going to be focused so much on McDermott that will really help Chapman. But if teams can just let McDermott get his 25 a night and really put the pressure on Chapman, I think that is how you attack this Creighton Blue Jays team. You can't think about McDermott. You're not going to stop him. The mid-major team that's really captured my attention, I'll let David jump in here.
Okay. Well, David, let me ask you this. I mean, outside of Creighton, I mean, Wichita State is ranked top 50 Ken Pom to start the season, but they lost everybody from last year, basically.
Yeah, lost everybody. I'm not big on it. I'll tell you who I do like is, and this is kind of, last year I talked about Indiana State and how good I thought they were going to be, and they finished eighth. And I like another team this year. I like this Illinois State team. I know that they were rather underwhelming last year, but they really looked like they were getting it down the stretch, even in their losses. Like, you know, they lost some really close games on the road in overtime. They
right.
went all the way to the conference championship game, lost Creighton, and lost to Creighton in overtime. And I think they have four of their starters back. I mean, I could see them being kind of a dark horse in that conference. I don't think they're going to be as good as Creighton, but they might be good enough to play their way onto the bubble.
No, I think you're right. I mean, Jackie Carmichael, I believe, is back. And, again, a very good player, both offensively and his defensive rebounding percentage is one of the best in the country last year, not just the league, but the country.
Yeah.
You know, I think Tyler Brown is back this year. Nick Moore had a good freshman year, kind of an undersized guard, but a guy that was able to contribute some for them. They've got some options there, and they were a young team last year. They were, I think, 253rd in the nation in experience as far as minutes were concerned last year. So they'll
yeah.
be better just by default, I think. And, you know, they've got the schedule that they don't have a whole lot of challenges, but they do go to Drexel. They go to Louisville. They have a neutral site
yeah.
game against UAB, I think, in November. So They're challenging themselves a little bit. They got Dayton on the road, so it could be interesting to see how they're able to put things together. And I think that is a team to watch out for.
Yeah, and that's in a tournament. That's down in San Juan. So, I mean, the game against UAB. So, I mean, they could potentially face Dayton and Baylor and some decent teams down there.
I'm sorry,
Dayton and Baylor and Charleston. Right. Who owns down in San Juan? Okay.
I do think another team in the Missouri Valley that might bear some watching is Evansville. I mean,
that's where I was going to go.
Okay, well, I'll let you take it then. Go ahead.
Well, no, Evansville is a team that they're very strong on the defensive side of the basketball, and in a conference that's going to be really down, I think, especially offensively outside of Doug McDermott, I think that gives Evansville a chance to make a move. I don't know if they can be in the top three in the conference, but I think that they play well enough on both sides of the ball where they can pick off a couple of the bigger teams. I think they're a team. If you want to look at a team that's got a chance to maybe take down Creighton, unless you want to go out and say Creighton's going to run the table in the Missouri Valley, and I don't think it's a crazy statement. I don't think it'll happen. Evansville, a team that is one of the teams that they're going to have to look out for. They have Creighton on Saturday, February 16th. It's a national televised home game. I think that is probably one of the two or three toughest games Creighton's going to have in the conference this year.
Yeah, and, it's interesting because we're going to get a good look at Evansville right out of the gate. They play at Notre Dame on Saturday of this week. And,
that's a good game.
Yeah, that's kind of a stealth game. They're at Butler on the 22nd of December. Mm-hmm. Then they're at Creighton 7 days later, absolutely. But they travel to Colorado State. They have Murray State at home. They've got a bunch of crap on the rest of their schedule.
The conference.
You're right. The conference schedule looks bad, but those non-conference games that they do play aren't bad, and I'll be curious to see how they fare because I look at teams like Colorado State and Murray State and Butler as kind of being in the same general milieu as Evansville is right now, and so it'll be interesting to see how they stack up against those squads.
I think we'll get a good look at them real quick because if they don't show us something by the Butler game, then we're probably not going to have to worry about it. We're not going to be thinking about them very long because by then they'll have had the game at Notre Dame, the game at altitude at Colorado State, a game against Miami, Ohio, a game against Murray State, and the Butler game. I'm interested, speaking of, we always talk about scheduling, the Alabama State and Oakland City games leading into road games at Butler and Creighton. I don't think that's the smartest bit of scheduling they could have come up with.
Well, maybe they just want to. They want to rest up. Oakland City is like 20 minutes away from Evansville. That's another – I think they're an NAIA school, very small school.
I mean, Oakland wasn't available?
No, Oakland City was what they had to settle.
Right, that disappoints me. But it's an interesting schedule because they have a couple of really good out-of-conference games, and it's still a terrible schedule.
Yeah.
They really found a way. I give them credit.
It's hard to pull off. Anyway, let's jump conferences once again. And let's head over to the West Coast Conference. Speaking of top heavy, you've got again the same three teams have risen to the top once more. Of course, St. Mary's, Gonzaga, and BYU all making the tournament last year, all winning 26 or more games. They all won 12 or more conference games. Those same three teams appear to be probably in that order: Gonzaga, St. Mary's, BYU. The class of this conference, there's not a whole lot else to recommend. I guess the question is, how good can those three teams be? Kyle, I've heard people describe this Gonzaga team as maybe the best one Mark Few has had. I feel like I've heard that sort of talk before, which makes me a little bit leery about it. Is Kyle still with us?
Sorry, I had myself on mute there.
Anyway,
thought you were stunned by the claim.
I will say this. I think this is the most well-rounded team that Gonzaga has had. I really like, between Pangos and Harris, and the depth they've got inside. I think from top to bottom, they've got a very well-rounded roster. But I'm not sure it's quite as talented as some of the other teams he's had. Could it end up being his best team? Maybe. I really do like the depth of this team, but But I'm just not sure they have the upper level talent. You know, they don't have a Robert Sacre inside this year, which is something I think that people are going to take notice of. I mean, I don't think they realize how important he was a player for them last year. So they're not going to have. I mean, make no mistake, they've got some size. I mean, they've got a couple 7-footers on the roster, but without him inside, they're not going to be the same type of team. Now, I love Pangos. I like Stockton a lot. You know, Bell is supposed to be a really good guard. And Harris I love as a forward. But, I guess long story short, I'm not sure if I agree with that. I think it's a very well-rounded team. I'm just not sure it's his most talented team.
Anybody else want to look at this? I mean, David, any thoughts from you regarding this team?
I pretty much just to echo what Kyle said. They're really good, and I think saying that it's the best one he's ever had is a bit of a stretch. I guess we'll find out kind of quickly because they're out of conference schedule. It has its, quite a bit of meat on it. They're at West Virginia. They have West Virginia at home. Clemson, who's decent. They go to Wazoo, Kansas State, Baylor, Oklahoma State, New Year's Eve. So, I mean, I guess we'll find out what they're all about. I think they're a good team. I think that they could even contend for a protected seed. But, I mean, again, Few has had some really, really good teams. I don't think this is the best one he's ever had.
Well, Lee, as we let's get off Gonzaga, let's look at these other two teams then. I mean, St. Mary's last year, they started off like gangbusters, and then they kind of fell apart at the end of the season. They did win the West Coast Conference tournament, obviously, but then they lost to Purdue in the NCAA tournament by 3. That was a little bit of a surprise. They weren't a very good defensive team last year. And, they lose Rob Jones. They lose Kenton Walker. They've got some pieces back. Dellavedova's back. But I kind of get the feeling with St. Mary's, like, last year was their year, and they didn't really capitalize on it, and they're not going to be as good this year. I don't know, am I reading this wrong, or do they just they have the mark of an 8, 9, 10 seed to you?
Yeah, I think people are overselling Gonzaga and actually underselling St. Mary's. By the way, real quick, I'm interested to see how Kyle Dragunas develops at Gonzaga, the two-time Idaho State Player of the Year. He's actually supposed to be a very – despite Idaho's lacking basketball background, he is supposed to be a very good player, and it'll be interesting to see how the redshirt freshman can add size to Gonzaga. I agree with what David and Kyle said. I think just because you're a well-constructed roster doesn't automatically mean you're a good team. St. Mary's, on the other hand, I think is a very good team. I really like this team. They bring back Dellavedova. He got the experience playing in London. They are returning 4 starters, and they bring back, to bring back Dellavedova, I think, is huge for them. I think their depth is really kind of underrated. I think they've got, they're bringing in the fact that they've got Matt Hodgson coming in from Southern Utah, who is actually a solid front court player. Last year, he had a redshirt, so they add him. They've also got the combo of Stephen Hill and Jordan Page. Page has got the ability to really take his game to another level. I think Page is going to carry them if they want to be more than just a fringy 10-11 seed team. I think he can do that. I mean, he was a guy who was great for them in spurts. They need Page to be consistent, and I think he has now more of a stage to do that. They've got a JUCO transfer who's got a lot of hype behind him, and James Walker. He was the Southern California JUCO Player of the Year, and that's a pretty big pool to be pulling from. They've still got some questions, though. You got Paul McCoy, who's still trying to get his knee in shape. They're hoping he can get back and be the player he was as a sophomore at SMU. I don't think they can cast too much hope in McCoy. You have to just hope that you get him. I like this St. Mary's team. I really do. I'm going to pull up the full schedule to get a full look at them. I haven't gotten to really delve into it, but I'm a fan of them. I mean, when you return the best player in the conference, you're still going to be pretty good, obviously. They've got a trip to Utah State, who this year is not going to be good. I don't care what the record says. Utah State, they're not good this year. They've got Drexel in a non-conference game, which will be interesting. They travel to Drake. It's not a great non-conference schedule. I love the fact that on New Year's Eve they're playing Harvard. I think that's awesome. It's a light schedule. They got a game at Northern Iowa. They play a lot of teams where a couple of years ago this would have been a great schedule.
Right.
But this year I don't think is very good. I think St. Mary's, while I think they're underrated, they are going to build up a gaudy record. I don't know where they're going to be able to get an impact win out of conference on this. I don't think they have a chance of getting a decent out-of-conference win here.
I'll tell you who I like the non-conference schedule of the most. Well, I mean, Gonzaga's is good, but outside of them, Brigham Young actually did not schedule poorly. They've got Florida State in a neutral site. I think that's a tournament, but I'm not sure which tournament it is.
It's the one that's on True TV. I want to say it's not the Battle for Atlantis. I think Paradise Jam.
Okay, Paradise Jam. They're at Iowa State. They've got Utah State at home, who, as you said, won't be good, and they're at Baylor. So they've got some opportunities there to pick up some decent wins. They also have Virginia Tech in a semi home game on the 29th.
And you say semi home. Where are they playing?
I'm pretty sure they're playing in Salt Lake City.
Okay, and they've also got – they have road trips to Iowa State and Baylor.
So, yeah, I mentioned that.
Did you mention Iowa State? Well, anyway.
Weber State game might be kind of challenging too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that you're all over. Weber State's a dangerous team. I'll be interested to see how good they are without Damian Lillard, who right now, 3 games into the year, looks like the best rookie in the NBA, which I did not expect.
Very few people expected that, I think. Yes. So – anyway, not a whole lot else to mention in the West Coast Conference, really. This is going to be a three-horse race, and I don't even know if all three horses are going to finish as far as being tournament teams. You get outside of those leagues, though. There's not a whole lot else out there in mid-major land. I mean, we talked a little bit about the Atlantic 10 last week. The Colonial lost arguably its best, most consistent team in Virginia Commonwealth. They've got Drexel, that's the only top 100 team in the Pomeroy preseason ratings, and Drexel should be very good, but
they're going to be very good. Yeah.
But that's it. I mean, really, you look at the rest of the teams that are in there, they're not going to be facing much of a fight. The Horizon League loses Butler, and suddenly, who do they have? Cleveland State? Wisconsin, Green Bay, maybe? I mean, they're going to struggle to find an identity, I think, with Butler finally out of that league. Metro Atlantic, I don't
think scale.
Yeah, it stinks. It's terrible. The Western Athletic Conference, Denver might be okay. They've showed a few flashes during the year last year, but that's I don't really anticipate them doing much. The point I'm trying to make, I guess, is this could be an incredibly top-heavy year in college basketball because you get past those top 9 conferences, top 10 conferences, and there's really not much else below. There might be a couple of teams that pop up out of the woodwork, but they're really going to have to struggle to get to that point.
Right. And I think there are a smattering of good teams. It's just that they're spread out. Like, they're not in the same conferences. Like, I think this South Dakota State team can be good. I think the game on Friday at Alabama is hugely important because it's one of their few chances at a statement road win. And who knows how much of a statement that's going to be. But expect South Dakota State to run up a big record. They were in the tournament last year. They have a lot coming back. You already talked about Drexel. I love Davidson. If you've been reading the Hoops HD, they have all their starters back. They were good last year. We were even looking at them as an at-large until they stubbed their toes a few times. I think that's a very good Davidson team. And Davidson's playing a rather meaty out-of-conference schedule, so they could build a case for themselves.
Yeah, just to hit on that, they're at New Mexico. They are they're in a tournament. They've got Vanderbilt as their first game in that tournament. They play Drexel on the road. They play Richmond on the road. They have Duke on a neutral floor. So there are some opportunities for them in the non-conference. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think there's a smattering. We talked about Lehigh a little bit. I don't know if they're quite to the level of it at large. The Sun Belt, Middle Tennessee, has 10 of their top 12 scorers back. They're going to be real good. They were a 2017 win a year ago. Again, their biggest problem this year is going to be what they faced last year. There's no opportunities for marquee wins, but they could still be pretty good.
Lee, hold on. We're almost out of time here, but Lee, you had a team that you wanted to get to real quick?
Yeah, it's a team that we haven't mentioned, and it's a team that's got a really good out-of-conference schedule, and they finally got it at the end of last year, the Detroit Titans. They bring back Ray McCallum Jr. They bring back – he's one of three returning starters. They looked great at the end of last year. They went to the second round of the tournament before falling to Kansas. They're a year older. They got games at St. John's, at Pitt, at Miami, at Syracuse, at Temple. I think Ray McCallum and Detroit. And you want to look for a mid-major this year. It's always a team that has one really superstar player. That could be Ray McCallum, a year older.
You may be right. They finished last year on fire. I mean, they won, I think, 10 of their last 12 games in Horizon League, and they, of course, won the Horizon League tournament. They're one to keep an eye on, obviously. So
yeah, I got one more, and I want to get Kyle's take on this.
We've got 20
has
seconds.
All starters back.
We've got 20
Ohio
seconds.
University has all their starters back.
Kyle, final word.
I'm going to opt for time here, so I'll defer.
All right. We're out of time, folks. Thanks for joining us on the Bracket Racket. We will catch you next week at 9 o'clock. So long, everybody.